Blog Talk Radio.
They are amazing examples of women who have beaten the odds to rise to the top. When you see their smiling faces, you forget about the obstacles that they faced to climb their career ladders of success. Their smiles are definitely disarming, but underneath it all is a steel magnolia who is resilient, tough, and strong. And today's show will give you a glimpse of how they made it in the world of work. We're talking about executive women at the top. I'm Carol Copeland Thomas, and you are listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hello, everyone. We're glad that you joined the show. This is Carol Copeland Thomas. We're in the middle of the summer. It's wonderful here in the greater Boston area, and we hope it's nice and sunny or at least pleasant wherever you happen to be. We're really glad that you've joined the show. We encourage you to go to the website and learn more about the Multicultural Symposium Series. Have always had a monthly contest where we're bringing in more members by the day, and we'd love to have you a part of the initiative. You can go to www.mssconnect.com to learn more about membership and the benefits of it. We actually had a webinar last night, and all members are able to participate with our webinar series that takes place every month. So you can go again to www.mssconnect.com to learn more about the Multicultural Symposium Series and certainly learn more about my speaking and training services. Also, a little bit of a correction. Last week, I told you about the Roxbury Film Festival that I thought took place last week, but I was a week early. The Roxbury Film Festival is going on right now. So if you are in the greater Boston area, we encourage you to check out some of the finest films that are out there. It's an international film festival, shorts, long featured films, just a terrific collection of independent filmmakers who are really expressing themselves on the medium. So you can check it out at roxburyfilmfestival.org. That's RoxburyFilmFestival.org, and see the lineup between now and Sunday. There are actually going to be films, feature-length films, that are going to be running between today. This is Thursday. The opening kickoff is tonight, and then straight through the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there'll be a whole lineup of wonderful films, so check it out, and we'd love for you to support them and go see some of the finest independent filmmakers in the country. Well, I am excited about the lineup today. I have two, not strangers, but two friends. One, a high school buddy who has risen to the top, and another, a cousin. We're going to talk to Jackie Gaines a little bit later on, president and CEO, former president and CEO of a major hospital chain, first in Oregon and then in Pennsylvania. So we'll talk to her later. But now we're going to talk to the author of a great new book called Cracking the Double Standard Code, A Guide to Successful Navigation in the Workplace. And she has had, I think, a fascinating and very non-traditional career path. You don't necessarily see women rising to the top of the Drug Enforcement Agency, but she has done so. So without further ado, I want to bring on my friend and colleague, June Wertelow Rogers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's my pleasure.
I'm just glad to have you on. First of all, let's take us way back 20-plus years ago, 30 years ago, when you started out as a beat cop in Detroit. How did that come about, and how were your interests directed from Cass Technical High School to the Detroit Police Department?
Yeah, that's why. You went to Cass, too. Rock that green and white.
There you go.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting when you think about it. My plans were to be a social worker, and there was an economics class at Wayne State University that I knew no matter how hard I tried to get through it, I probably was going to have problems and was not going to get the kind of grade that I needed to get to remain in the social work program. So I switched to criminal justice, thinking that maybe I'd be a parole officer or probation officer because that still kind of had a social work component to it. But having changed my major around that same time, the Detroit Police were hiring, and I filled out an application, and I really was just, you know, putting the application in without much intent or thought for working with them. But the more that they seemed to be interested in me, the more that I got interested in the police department and the whole field of policing. And by the time they offered me the job, I said yes, and I believe it was one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life.
Wow. Huh. So the safety factor didn't bother you. Know, during that time, during the 70s, things were really hot and heavy in Detroit. So you didn't have an issue with coming out of undergraduate and moving into a police force that was really active on the street because of all the drug activity that was taking place in Detroit?
Actually, no. My family did. My grandmother, I mean, she made a joke about getting extra insurance on me if I decided I wanted to go that way. I think she was just trying to convince me to not go into law enforcement. But for me, it was all about public service. And, you know, no one wants to put their life in harm's way. But I feel like if you're going to do it, doing it to try to save others and take care of public safety is the way to do it. So public service, I knew, was what I wanted to do with my life. And I guess now, older, thinking about it, you don't think about it the same way when you're younger. And
right.
I was just 19 at the time.
Yeah, you just march right in there. Wow. So you were laid off. Your career path with Detroit put you in another direction. What happened then?
Well, I went back to school because I dropped out, and to be quite honest, if they hadn't laid me off, I probably would have never went back to school. So after about a year, I finished up my bachelor's and still hoped that they would call me back, and they didn't. And so I started to look at other positions, and Central Michigan University's Department of Public Safety had a vacancy, and they offered the job to me three times, and the third time I said yes, but I had reservations. I was a homegirl from Detroit. Didn't really know much more about the fact. I know Michigan's a big state. I know that now, but at the time, I was just like, I'm not going up there. And but again, back to it turned out to have been the next best decision that I made because I went up there. They paid for my master's degree. I got a chance to get outside of my comfort zone. As a minority in some place like Detroit, although I heard that I was a minority, the city at the time was probably 65 to 70% African American, so I really didn't feel like a minority. It wasn't until I got out into the greater Michigan area that I came to realize that I really was a minority and became more comfortable around people who didn't look like me.
Probably an interesting culture shock, too. I can only imagine. I mean, Detroit, you know, you and I both grew up in the city, and so you're around people who look like you. But then if you really drive 35 miles outside of Detroit, certainly during that time, it was like night and day, a different world altogether.
Yes, it was.
So you continued to stay in law enforcement at Central Michigan.
Yeah, and I did finish up a master's there, and I tried on a new degree, so to speak. I got the master's in counseling, and I became a residence hall director for just a very little while. I want to say probably after doing that about 2 months is when I said, if Detroit's not going to call me back right away, I need to look at the federal government and the possibility for working in law enforcement because at that point, I knew for sure that that was exactly what I wanted to do. So I applied for a few federal agencies, and DEA was the first one to contact me with a job offer, and so I went for it.
Wow. And tell us, what was it like, and obviously all of these experiences have gone into your book, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, but tell us about the early days. You know, you had the training, obviously, in the Detroit Police Force, and then you went to probably a smaller agency, and then you're in the big wide world of DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. What was that transition like for you?
Well, I mean, obviously there were some things that weren't as difficult to deal with because I had been in law enforcement. But, you know, if you think of the fact that you're in uniform, your whole point is to be very visible. But now I had went on board with an agency that was covert, and so it's not, you know, public safety from the standpoint of people seeing you. Now you're trying to do everything you can to become invisible. Not only that, I didn't have any experience with drugs before I started working with DEA, so you're learning about the various drugs, and you're going out, and you're engaging in undercover behavior, and it really was quite a bit of a challenge, but I think there was just so much going on at once. And I was so committed to the fact that I wanted to do a good job and recognizing just how horrible drugs are and how they are adversely affecting our nation that I just wanted to get in there and do a really good job. So I didn't really think about things like the danger aspect and some of the other things that people frequently come up to me and say, oh, my goodness, you used to do that? How could you do it? Well, we do a lot of things when we realize just how important it is and what's at stake if we don't.
And what was it like, too? Were there, give us a sense of the camaraderie that you had with other women in the agency. Were there many women in the agency? We're talking about, what, the late 70s, during the 80s. And what was that relationship like with you and other women in the agency?
Well, that was what I was just about to say, what women. There really were not that many. And because of that, we have a tendency for the few women that are in an agency to disperse us so that, you know, there's a woman to every group, so to speak. And it was good to see other women on the job. It's just that we didn't get a chance to see each other that often.
Well, clearly it worked for you. It worked for you from an advantage point of view because you rose quickly to become the bureau chief here in the Boston area. What was that process like?
Well, it seemed like it happened fast in some respects, and then in other respects I looked back and I realized that I became the special agent in charge there in the New England area when I had about 3 years to go before I was eligible for retirement. So it was somewhat rapid, but at the same time, you know, there were all these deliberate steps that you go through. Like first I had to become a group supervisor, which is a first-line supervisor of a group, and from there you move up to assistant special agent in charge, and then I was an associate back in Houston for a while before becoming a special agent in charge. And in each of those critical positions, you learn a lot, and hopefully you can build on the things that you've learned. And so I would just say that all of it was a learning experience. All of it was quite sobering because I went from being a street agent myself to not necessarily giving much thought to my own personal safety, but when someone puts in your hand the responsibility of other people, that's very sobering. When you're reviewing operations and deciding which direction to go in, you come to realize just how important and essential what you're doing is and how important it is for you to get it right.
How is it in your position, and I talk to lots of women who are in executive positions like you, and so often I hear the piece about the fact that you had a mentor. There are mentors along the way that helped you with your career path. Was that the same thing with you, June Rogers?
No, I have to say that I really didn't necessarily have mentors in a traditional sense, you know, people who were working with me one-on-one. It was more of taking a look at some folks and what they were doing and kind of admiring their work and saying, hey, I like how they're handling this and I like what they're doing and emulating things more from a shadowing standpoint. I know one of my early mentor, I guess isn't the right word, but a woman who really inspired me, believe it or not, was Barbara Jordan. Way back in the mid-70s. Yeah, that congresswoman. She was just so strong and just so justice-minded and wanting to root out corruption. And I was just so taken with her. And fiercely patriotic, too, as well.
Well, she's certainly one of my sheroes, and I've talked and written about her in the past, and she's a legend. She's passed on, but a real legend, Texas U.S. Congresswoman, and never forget her 1968 speech at the Democratic Convention. That was just riveting. She's just a real powerhouse. So all of this led to you, first of all, retiring from DEA, clearly an early retirement, but a retirement nonetheless. To writing this book, Cracking the Double Standard Code, A Guide to Successful Navigation in the Workplace, how long did it take you to write the book? And, you know, walk us through the phase that you went through from the early ideas to the actual publication of this book.
Okay. Well, you know, I knew I wanted to write another book. This is my second book when I retired, but I actually thought that I was going to write about violent crime. And I had all my notes and everything ready to do that. I had taken some of them before I retired. And then one day I'm just, you know, out on a power walk, and I'm thinking about, well, you know, what kinds of things can you do to help women in particular who are still on a job working in a male-dominated environment to be all that they can be? And and things just started to, you know, flood my mind, and I started taking notes because I really feel like women who are working in male-dominated environments need to have ways to know how to navigate what I believe is a clear double standard that they face. I think a lot of times, and in my case, I'm really grateful it didn't happen to me, but I've seen women and I've seen other minorities become very discouraged and bitter because of the fact that they see people who don't look like them, people in the majority doing very well, not facing certain obstacles and pitfalls and roadblocks, and then they have to, you know, climb up the rough side of the mountain to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you can still excel, and it helps if you realize what's going on as early as possible. So there were two things I really wanted to do in the book is, one, to kind of give people a reality check, because I think sometimes you feel like you're going crazy, like, wait a minute, I just said this particular thing right here, and everyone thought it was a horrible idea, and then like a second later, the person sitting right next to me, they say the same identical thing, and now all of a sudden, this is a really great idea.
Oh,
and I'm thinking, yeah, and most women have faced that, and I can tell you have either. You have as well.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, I thought you were going to say something.
That's a frequent example of how your credibility can be undermined just because you are female, and the person who picks up your idea and then champions it and runs with it and then takes credit for it may not be a female, but then gets all the credit because of who he is. Yeah.
Right. And so I'm thinking, you know, how many women out here on our own, because just about any woman who is successful could have written this book, because on their own they've kind of navigated through those pitfalls and came to learn, well, wait a minute, no, it's not me, I'm crazy. But probably just as many women have kind of fallen by the wayside because they never quite realized that it wasn't in their head. So the first part of the book is of every chapter is, you're not crazy, these things are real. And then I go on at the second part of each chapter to get into some real live advice, some things that you can do to navigate the various double standards that are out there. So that was
the
primary reason.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about in the early part of your book, you have a chapter entitled Women Cannot Fly Below Radar. Talk to us about that.
Well, I mean, we stand out, right, wrong, or indifferent. And I know, you know, a lot of this just really seems to be unfair. But if you look at any particular thing, if you look at a, you know, a white page of paper and the black words, they jump out at you because that's different from the background. And that's basically what happens when you're a minority. In whatever setting you happen to be in, people are going to notice you first. Now, I try to get, you know, folks, to see, just because you notice something first doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the thing that you're noticing. Mm-hmm. But be as it may, that's the reality that women and many ethnic minorities face, is that people will notice you, which basically means you can't hide. You cannot hide in the sea of everything else that looks the same. You are going to be noticed, and recognize that and use it to your advantage. Hey,
right,
people are noticing me, so I need to put my best foot forward. No one really should be thinking about how they can hide and how they can shirk their responsibilities. There is a double standard out there, but I think in most cases the standards are not unreasonable. We just need to know that they're out there and work hard to do the best that we can in our job.
How did you handle the double standards on your job? I mean, clearly you're dealing, first of all, with safety issues. You've already talked about the leadership role that you had to play and the enormous responsibility of people whose lives were literally in your hands. How did you gain the trust of your fellow officers, the male officers, who may have been your colleagues at one point in time, and then they became your subordinates. How did you make that transition from colleague to leader and continue having the respect of those who worked under you?
I think, again, a lot of the stuff, it wasn't because I gave a conscious thought to it. I kind of was sort of the accidental tourist. But I think the thing that made the biggest difference was being mission-focused. I always had to be mindful of why it was that I raised my right hand and took the oath of office and wore the badge. And that was to try to rid our nation of drugs through arresting drug dealers and getting drugs off the street. And when you're really focused on the mission, a lot of the other stuff that just kind of falls away by the wayside. You're not somewhere trying to figure out how to get out of work, and you're doing the best that you can possibly do. Now, that's not to say that I was perfect and that I did everything right, but I think because my heart was in the right place and I was willing to put hard work behind it, things worked out well.
So the mission focus, I'm listening to what you're saying very carefully. That clearly was, I guess, your driving point and something that that anchored you with the various career moves that you made. One of the chapters you also have in your book talks about women must prove themselves over and over again. Now, I've heard this for African Americans, where we have to prove ourselves over and over again, and certainly you're using it in the context of women. How have you seen in your own career path or maybe in other career paths where women have, again, these double standards again, where you have to prove that you are credible and capable for the job at hand?
Yeah, and I have to, add to that. It is so frustrating because, you're going about your work and you're doing everything you can to be the best that you can be. And then, someone new shows up and now all of a sudden they're like, okay, well, who is she? I would say it's something that could easily, if you think about it too much, you could become very frustrated by it. But again, if you're really about business and you're focusing in on the job, that's going to happen anyway. You're going to be proving yourself because that's part of what you need to do in order to drive forth the mission and to do the best possible job that you can. I would just say the best advice I had to offer is to recognize that that's there, but not to focus and become bitter that, other folks don't have to prove themselves. Because the reality is that, we really should. When someone asks that question, what have you done for me lately? That should not be a hard response for any of us to deliver if we're really serious about the work that we do.
We're talking to June Wardlaw Rogers, and she is a former DEA chief here in the Boston area, now retired, and now the new author of Cracking the Double Standard Code, A Guide to Successful Navigation in the Workplace. And if you'd like to ask a question, if you're already on the line, you can just click, I believe it's number one, and you raise your hand, and we'll be happy to bring you on so that you can ask a question. We also thank those who are listening in the chat room, and if you'd like to ask a question, you can either send me an email at tellcarol, TELLCAROLE, at mac.com, or if you're registered with Blog Talk, you can just go on and chat away in the chat room. We thank so much. Now, one of the things that I was sort of amused with, and I wanted to bring this up, is your whole discussion about Sarah Palin. You use her as a case study in your book. Talk to us about why she was important enough to be in your book and how her particular career path is sort of an example of the double standards that you're talking about with your book, June Rogers.
Well, I guess, amusing is a word that does come to mind. I also think it's a little amusing in that when the publisher did a press release about the book coming out last month, there was someone who ended up writing an article about it, and the headline was Former Drug Agent Has Got Sarah Palin's Back. And I guess probably a better headline to me would be that, I have, all women's back, because I think, and I have to say this, I got to get this out before I forget. The mystery has not been solved, by the way. On Facebook, I started a mystery question because I sent Sarah Palin a copy of my book. And I don't know if she actually received it, and I'm not sure if she's read it. And if she did read it, I don't know what her reaction is. So if there are any listeners that can solve that mystery, please drop me a line and let me know. You know, there is literally not a fictional character that I could have come up with who, and Sarah Palin, like many women in leadership, faced a double standard. And for every chapter that I wrote about, what I did was to go back and take a look at how she stacked up in terms of this double standard code. And she fell short in many different areas. There were a couple where I think that she navigated artfully, but by and large, in most cases, if you looked at what she was facing, I don't think that she navigated the double standard code very well. And I also
I look at her, and she's a very interesting woman. Clearly, she's been very successful. But the concern I have about her is that she is taking full advantage of her being in the limelight. And in many ways, she uses her family, she uses those daughters, she uses her own personal circumstances to get her to the next level. I think she's going to run for office, going to run for president in 2012. Her credentials, everybody talks about. Whether she has the real leadership capabilities, everyone talks about. I seriously doubt that. But I look at her, and I wonder who is the real Sarah Palin. I see someone who is beloved by the Tea Party, but is that really who she is, or is she using that audience to really obviously make money, write more books, and to become famous?
You know, I look at people's behavior. I think that that's the best way we can judge their motives and their intentions. And I think what we can say about Sarah Palin, if we look at what she did, she had a job as the governor of Alaska where she was in a leadership position. She opted to no longer continue in that position and instead become more like a television, radio, Facebook personality. And so I guess she has to ask herself the question if she does want to run in 2012 and be the leader of this great nation, if she has the goods to not just run for the job, but to actually do the job. And
that's the $64,000 question. Can she actually? Yeah. I mean, clearly she would have a lot of people who would vote for her, but from a leadership point of view, does she have the sustainability to govern? And leading, running a campaign is one thing. Governing, as we're certainly seeing with our President Obama, that's a totally different ball of wax altogether. You've got the forces of everybody coming at you all at the same time, and you have one crisis to solve after the other. So, I mean, she wouldn't be able to escape to Facebook or go on Fox News or whatever as president. That would be just, governing would just be a different animal, and I'm not sure she has the capability of really governing.
It's true, and slinging mud, you know, you have to do more than just sling mud in order to be good at what you do.
That's so true, and this is a very tough, complicated country that we are in with just enormous obstacles along the way. When you look at your job back at DEA, who comes to mind, without naming the person, but if you can just sort of think about an experience where you had to lead another woman, where you had to advise or counsel another woman who was emulating you, looking at you, wanting to be like you from a leadership perspective? Who comes to mind, or what situation comes to mind with that example?
I would say there's a young lady who just recently became a first line supervisor, and she reached out to me and said, you know, do you have any advice to offer me? And it's amazing because right about that same time I was finishing up the book, and I ended up having a conversation with her, and we went down literally chapter by chapter. And you know, that's really what the book was designed to do. You know, they say you can take a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And I think that's why I got out of counseling and realized that law enforcement was really for me. I want to be the one. I'm not really designed, I think, to be the one to drag someone to the water. But what I'd like to be is when you decide that you want the answers, here they are. Here's the pool of water. Here's the towel. Here's everything that you need in order to be what you want to be, but that decision has to be from the other person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're providing that inspiration, hoping that the other person, in this case a woman, will be able to pick up the charge and run with it. Am I sort of paraphrasing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have every confidence that this particular woman will. And I have a lot of faith in my sisters everywhere. I started to get some feedback on the book. I know you never know when you write whether or not, you know, you're actually hitting the mark. And when I started to get some of the endorsements, you know, like Carolyn Caffin with the Michigan Women's Foundation saying the book is like a GPS for women, and now I'm starting to get some emails from some of the women who are reading the book, and mm-hmm. they're indicating that they love it and that it's useful and it's like, you know, the coach that they never had. And so I really feel like it has turned out to be a valuable tool. And that's what this is really all about at the end of the day, you know, writing a book with a message that will help people be all that they can be.
We're talking to June Wardlow Rogers. She is the former bureau chief in the Boston, the New England area for Drug Enforcement Administration. She's also the author of Cracking the Double Standard Code. Now, you've walked us through your own history and talked about the jobs that you have held, that you didn't really have a mentor, but you certainly looked at identified individuals like Barbara Jordan who were helpful to you along the way. In your book, you talk about tokenism. You have a chapter called The Indecent Proposal Tokenism. So often when I'm thinking about you, I'm thinking about my next guest who I'm going to interview shortly, you're at the top, but you're alone and not many women with you. Do you think that's going to change? Do you think there are going to be more opportunities in many industries, not just law enforcement, but healthcare, certainly in various aspects of business, where women are going to take charge in greater numbers?
Absolutely, and I'm really excited about it. And again, another reason why I wrote the book. Sometimes the reasons why women haven't stepped out there is because they're fearful. They see that double standard. They know that there's going to be more attention, that they can't fly below the radar. And I think as more and more women step out and realize that the waters might be a little bit more uncomfortable, it's sort of like, you know, any water, you put your foot in and first it's either too hot or too cold, and then you put the rest of yourself in, and before you know it, you're okay with those waters. And so I mean, we see it everywhere. We see it in government. We see it in our elected politicians, and women are just, we're just basically taking over. We make up more of the percentage of men in the population of America, so I truly expect to see more, yes.
What do you still see as obstacles standing in the way of women? And again, I go back and I think about a project that I worked on for a teaching hospital here in the greater Boston area some time ago. I did a cultural audit, a diversity cultural audit. And one of the stumbling blocks was not necessarily the women who were in the pipeline for leadership roles as physicians and being leaders for this particular hospital, but just the fact that they had a balancing act that was very difficult for them. Women who had families, they had to go home at night and take care of husbands and children and then come to this hospital and work long, very long hours. Could they, in fact, take on a leadership role that would actually increase their workload? And that was very difficult for some of the women I talked to really say, yes, I can step up to that plate and take care of all my other responsibilities. What are you looking at, June, in terms of some of these same kind of obstacles that are hitting women who definitely have the capability, they have the leadership talent, the potential, but the obstacles can certainly be in their way?
You know, it is real. In fact, you know, one of the chapters I have in the book is Give Her the Postpartum Blues, in that I know that women who have children face more obstacles, and they have a lot of things they have to deal with. I get back to not being fearful, because fear can cripple us. A lot of times you'll speak to people and they'll say, well, you know, I'd like to do this, but I just don't know how I can juggle all of those balls. It was like when I worked on my PhD during the same time that I was working for DEA. If you stop and you think about all the balls that you have to juggle, it's enough to paralyze you from doing anything. And
right.
I know it's, you know, it's one of those cliches out there, just do it, but I really think it comes down to that, because when you speak to any woman or any man for that matter who has done things and you say to yourself, they climbed that mountain, how could they do it? And they would tell you that they didn't know how they were going to do it either when they first started out, but they just went one step at a time, and before they knew it, they were able to achieve that which that they were looking to accomplish. So I guess that's the best advice I can offer. I know it's cheesy, but if you step out and start doing it, you'll be surprised how much easier it turns out it was than what you thought it would be.
I think also with some women, particularly those who have demanding heavy family responsibilities or personal responsibilities, or women who now find themselves taking care of elderly parents, which is just going everywhere, which is everywhere. When I would look at some of my friends, perhaps this chapter of your life is not necessarily the chapter where a large leadership role would make sense for you. Maybe another chapter, maybe in 2 or 3 years or 4 or 5 years, when you can take on more responsibility. Or if you find yourself where you do have heavy responsibility, heavy demands, maybe there's an opportunity for you to talk to your family and work with your family so that they can partner with you and they can take on some of those jobs that you're typically doing at home. Maybe your older kids can begin to do, or your husband can actually do, or your partner, whoever that happens to be. Now, I guess the point I'm trying to make, and I'd like your comments on this, is that you can't do it all, and you have to look at the timeline when you can increase your responsibilities on the job or off the job just to make sense.
I agree with you. And you know, that where there's a will, there's a way. I might add, for example, to go along with what you're saying, at the time that I worked on my PhD, I waited until I had an assignment that allowed me to be able to carve out some time to go to class. I didn't have a lot of courses that I had to take, mm-hmm. but when you're working in enforcement, you can't just leave an operation and say, I have to go to school now.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of operations that took place at night after hours, but when I was assigned to the Office of Training down at Quantico, Virginia, now I had a schedule that permitted me to be able to do the coursework. So I didn't leave. I didn't even put in for a supervisory position until I had finished the coursework, recognizing that everything else could be independent study, and that
right.
worked out. So, yes, you do have to look at your schedule and your life and see what fits in where.
And I think, too, women, again, this is a real tough one for women. We have to learn how to delegate. I know it's tough for me to delegate. I'm sure you've probably struggled with it, but there comes a point in time where delegation is just paramount, just finding staff members or people in your community or in your family who can, where you can offload some of those responsibilities so that you can go on and do other things.
That's absolutely true as well. And the key to delegation is just knowing what things to delegate and which things that you never, ever delegate. But
mm-hmm.
I think the artful leader recognizes, yes, I need help, and this is a way to develop my subordinate by allowing them to do this, and then these are some of the things that I have to, you know, keep responsibility for myself.
Right. We're talking, first of all, tell us where people can get your book, Cracking the Double Code, The Guide to Successful Navigation in the Workplace, June Rogers.
Of course, you can go directly to the publisher. It's Cable Publishing, and they can be reached at www.cablepublishing.com, and Cable Publishing is all run together. The book is also available at Amazon.com now, and I'm hoping that it will be on shelves at local bookstores very soon. So if you, some people only want to purchase a book from the bookstore, I say go in there, tell them you want the book, and that'll be a good way to help get it on the shelves as well.
Great. That's great. And in closing, what words of wisdom from your book, from your experiences that you can share with our audience as you embark upon this next chapter of your life, being retired from a terrific government position, but now becoming a leading spokesperson and author in your own right?
I would just say, listeners, you're not crazy, even if things seem to be different for you because you look different from everybody else. You can still make it. Your diversity is a strength, and your unique perspective is needed in the workplace. We're at a point in this nation where we need all hands on deck. And we all know, and I know many of you have been listening to this show for a long time, diversity is our strength. We need you.
That's a great, great tip. Would you like to give your own website?
Yes, please. It's www.urnotcrazy.com.
I love that. again, that's the letter U, R, the letter R, notcrazy.com. And you can also email June Rogers at jfieldrogers@comcast.net. June, thank you so much for being a guest on my program, and I wish you the very best, and I just can't wait for the next book to come out. This is a great one, a great guide. I think it is an excellent GPS for our listeners to follow, male or female, and we just say hats off to you and everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Carol, for having me. Have a good day.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, now you have heard the point of view and the experience on the drug enforcement side, someone who has just navigated the waters and clearly had lots of responsibilities, daunting responsibilities when you look at the task that June Rogers had. Now we're going to switch gears, but also look at someone who else was in a helping field. She started off as a nurse and then rose all the way up to becoming the president and CEO of a major hospital in the United States, first in Oregon and then in Pennsylvania. She is actually my cousin, and we had the opportunity of pre-recording this interview a couple of days ago. She's actually working in the field now and was not able to be with us live, but I think you're going to enjoy this interview. You're going to really learn an awful lot, as much as you learned from June Rogers, and she also is the author of a new book, Believing You Can Fly. We want to now bring on Jackie Gaines, so enjoy this interview. Well, I'm really delighted to talk with someone who I've known for probably almost a decade now based on our family connections, and I am really excited and honored that she is a cousin, but more importantly that she has done such a stellar job in the world of healthcare and certainly in the world of hospital administration and healthcare administration. Delighted to have from Clark Summit, Pennsylvania, Jackie Gaines. Hello, Jackie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you very much for having me.
You know, when we first connected, this was back as a result of the 2002 family reunion. We're part of the Gaines family. We were chatting and talking and had a chance to learn a lot about the work that you were doing, and I think at that time you were living in Portland or you were getting ready to head out to Portland. And at that same time, I was doing an audit for a large teaching hospital in the Boston area. I was doing a cultural competency audit for them and had the opportunity of talking with you, and then did some research and realized that there weren't a lot of women in leadership roles in the healthcare industry. Tell us about the experience that you've had as being one of very few women in hospital leadership.
Well, first of all, the journey, I guess, wasn't sort of a straight line from, you know, MBA to sitting in a chief executive's office and in that chair. It was quite a long and but a good journey that I wouldn't replace. I mean, even the bad stuff, I believe, helped me to be a better leader. I had lots of mentors in my life as well, but I actually started as a nurse,
mm-hmm.
and then became a nurse practitioner,
mm-hmm.
worked for a nonprofit, Healthcare for the Homeless in Baltimore, Maryland, and ended up running that eventually after about a couple years there and was seeing patients at the same time I had been appointed the president of that organization.
Wow.
It became a statewide model. I had gotten myself involved in national issues and public policy issues around poverty and health care in the country, and spent a lot of time in Washington doing some things. And so, you know, got exposed to, got on the national circuit a lot. And then had the opportunity to go back into the hospital side of business with a health system in Maryland that was challenged financially and hired me to do a turnaround with them.
So you're
and
a turnaround
basically
specialist.
a turnaround with them based on the work that I had been doing nationally for, you know, since the mid-'80s. So
right.
It was, they had seen me, you know, nationally, and that's when I got hired. And then my journey there got picked up by a health system, the Providence Health System in Portland, Oregon. Got the opportunity to be my first CEO position of running a hospital, which is totally, I think at the time that I got appointed, it was only maybe 6 or 7 minority women who had ever run a hospital in the country. And so it was a special and sad occasion because now we're into 2000. And I really didn't know, you know, that the numbers were so small because
right.
there are over 6,000 hospitals in the United States. And think about that, with only a handful of us running hospitals or having the opportunity. Now it's a double whammy because it's not just the being a minority that's the barrier, but it's been being a woman and
yeah.
a minority.
So it's a
majority
double,
of,
yeah, the
double
label that you're carrying with you.
Correct.
And, yeah, clearly, I remember again during that time and this audit that I did for this teaching hospital, some of the complications, because even this hospital was having problems with women going into leadership, senior leadership in that hospital. And they cited the work and family balance issues that many women had, that they had to clearly overcome the time circumstances, the probably the feelings that were in the midst with some of their male leaders, and we're talking about physicians in physicians' roles. How did you overcome all of that and step over that to lead you to a leadership position?
Well, you know, you have to be okay with who you are. You know, you have to have a comfort level in your own skin and in your skill set that you bring to the table. And I didn't go to the hospital world, you know, knowing everything. I had some incredible mentors in my life, including the president of American Hospital Association, who has been a mentor of mine for most of my career until he retired. And even after he retired, he continues to give me advice on what to do. And actually, it's so funny, because my first CEO job, even before I took the job, he told me, I was just a nurse and had no clue that I'd ever come this far in healthcare. He said, "You will be a hospital CEO."
Wow, he's
and I battled
that.
Him. I battled him and said, "Oh, you got to be kidding me. They'll never let me in to the good old boys network." And basically, he was right. He gave me the courage and inner strength, along with family and my husband, to really help me to get to the point where I am. And the more I, you know, he said, "Just do the work, Jackie. They can't deny the product." Mm-hmm. And I worked really hard, and, you know, and I produced for every place I went till I got to the next rung.
Yeah, I think you're saying very important things that our audience needs to hear. First of all, you were competent, obviously. You were trained. You clearly had potential that other people saw. You had a mentor. You had the right mentor, certainly, who was in a position to help you. And all of those sort of aligned you and allowed you to move from one level to the next. But I think the most important thing is that you had the personal confidence in yourself and probably the support network to get it done. How important is that in the role that you have played in terms of being a chief executive officer and with major hospital systems?
You mean having the confidence? You know,
yes.
It's funny, my parents always told me that I could be anything and do anything that I wanted to do. you know, that I could fly, which
that's
is
your book title.
You know,
you
that
fly.
I could fly. That's right, that I could fly, and not egotistically, but just that it, you know, you have to work harder because of your, you know, the fact that you do have this double whammy that you're a woman and that you are a minority. You're going to have to work three times harder than your male counterpart in order for you to be successful, mm-hmm. and that's what I did. And basically, you know, having that being told to you from a young child, you know, to an adult, and then getting that further support from mentors, it's been absolutely critical to the point where I mentor people all over the United States. I mentor people, and if someone asks me, and it's not just minorities, anybody, male, female, white, black, you name it, it doesn't matter. If they ask me, I will mentor them.
Wow.
And sometimes it's email, because I feel an obligation to give back what was given to me, and hopefully, you know, people can succeed in their own, you know, in their own right.
Tell us a little bit about the book, Believing You Can Fly. This is a memoir talking about your experiences going up the ladder of success. Share with us how this book came about.
Well, I've been, like, I've been on the national speaking circuit for more than two decades, and every time I would tell, and I'm a storyteller, so I love telling my story and blending it into a lesson learned or whatever I was talking about, depending on the topic. Even when it was about operational excellence, you know, I blend my stories in. And it's interesting because every time I would speak, someone would come up to me and say, Jackie, you really have to write this stuff down. And when I left my last job here in Pennsylvania to pursue other things, I decided I'm going to take a little hiatus and I'm going to write the book. And basically, my husband was on assignment in Portland working, and I was here by myself for a couple months, actually, and you know, put on my sweats, opened the computer, and started to write. And it was as if something just opened up in me, and I just kept writing and writing, and I couldn't stop. I literally would work. You know, my kids would call and say, "You all right, Mom?" And so, or my husband would call, and I'd say, "I'm writing. I'll talk to you later." And I was writing like 18 hours a day. I'd go to sleep thinking about what I wanted to say, and it's as if this message to other people, to hopefully my goal, it wasn't about money. It was more about I want to inspire one other individual.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been remarkable about the book, this little book, is that I have gotten more emails and calls and, you know, it's not even just minority women who have gotten something out of it. I'm talking, you pick a nationality or a gender, and people have come up to me saying how the book has touched their life. So,
well,
I guess I can check and say achieved.
It's believable. It's certainly easy to get through. You have wonderful pictures in here, and I think it is written like stories. You've got stories that you have combined into this wonderful personal journey about who you are and where you've gone and where you are going. Tell people where they can get a copy of Believing You Can Fly.
Actually, I would go right to the publisher. You can get it online. It's Dorance, Dorance, bookstore.com. And just either punch in Jackie Gaines or Believing You Can Fly, and there it is.
That's super. If you were, in closing, to give anyone, women or men, advice who are interested either in a higher level of leadership within their industry, or certainly if they're interested in healthcare as in a leadership role, what advice would you share with them, Jackie Gaines?
I think, first of all, don't go chasing a title. Chase, you know, we all do the best we can do when we're doing stuff that we love and that we're passionate about. And don't let that title get in your way. Try on all different kinds of shoes to figure out what your passion is, and then give it your all, and the money and the title will come. And people get so hung up in this 5-year plan kind of thing, and I got to be here. and they close the door to opportunity. If I had done that, I don't think I would be as far as I am, and I certainly wouldn't have written a book and all these other things. I just kept myself open to the possibilities, and that's what I would tell people. Don't toss away mentors. Seek them out if they're not seeking you out, and they will help to guide you. Lastly, believe in yourself and work hard. Nothing is given to you. You know, just believe in yourself.
That's great advice. And coupled with your book, Believing You Can Fly, we've talked to Jackie Gaines, and she is one of the few senior-level leader hospital administrators in the United States, going great guns, working all over the country. And I know that all the mentoring that you received, you're giving to other people, and that's a terrific, terrific model to follow. Jackie Gaines, thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Thank you, Carol, for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, you've actually heard from two women, and as I think about it, as I listen to Jackie Gaines' interview again, you're listening to two women who have been in non-traditional positions. First of all, drug enforcement, you just don't see a lot of women, you don't hear about them, and when you see someone who was an actual a bureau chief for a major region of the country, June Rogers, hats off to her, just an interesting person. But in her case, she didn't really have mentors, per se, that guided her along the way. Versus Jackie Gaines, there are, as Jackie had said, very few women in hospital administration. Again, I've done research in this and did this cultural audit and have worked in healthcare, and there are still very few women in hospital administration. Even though in droves you see women in nursing, you definitely see women in certified nursing assistants. In a lot of the ancillary roles in the hospitals, they run the hospitals, very important roles. But as you go up the ladder, as you see department heads, as you see physicians, as I had mentioned earlier, you just don't see a lot of women. And then when it comes to hospital administration, which is a growth industry, it is definitely a growth industry in this country. With the economy that we have, hospital administration is certainly an area that I would encourage women to go into because there aren't that many, but it is a growth area. And as you look at our aging process, what women are going through, we're going to need more health care as time goes on, and health care is just a really big topic. So I would love for you to think about and send me comments, send me names of other women like this. We would like to highlight them, have them on our show, sort of get their wisdom because they have an awful lot of wisdom. And you can only imagine the difficulties that they go through. Now, I know with June, June rose the ladder of success, and she recently married. So that's one example. And with Jackie Gaines, Jackie has been married to my cousin for decades, an awfully long time. She's a mom and a grandmother. So she had a very supportive, extremely supportive husband who walked with her. And I've seen a couple of examples of women who are in senior-level positions, and they are married to wonderful men who are not threatened by their leadership role, by the influence, the power that they have, and they walk with these women. That's what really it's going to take. If it's expected of women to support their husbands when they are in key positions, we want to have it on the flip side where women are supported by very devoted men who are confident and courageous enough to be men, but also to support the women who they're with. That really is the message that we want to have. This is a subject that is going to take a lot of flushing out. We're going to need to talk about it more and more going forward. It certainly has everything to do with empowerment. It has everything to do with diversity and multicultural issues. Women are going to increasingly play important roles in the world of politics and every in our world, in our country. But how can women navigate the challenges, the obstacles, the naysayers, the self-doubt that they have, all those videotapes that they have in their own head that tell them they can't do it? How can they navigate that to not only move on and become the leaders that they're supposed to become, but most importantly, reach back to those urging who can move on and move in their own footsteps? So it's a matter of not only getting to a level of excellence and leadership, but then turning around and paving the way, coaching, you certainly heard it from Jackie and June, paving the way so that other women can move in your own footstep. That is a discussion that we're going to have over and over again with this particular radio program, with the programs that I do, because I think it's going to really make or break us as a society, as a people, and as women on the go. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much for being listeners on my show. I hope you enjoyed everything today, and we'll be back next week with a very exciting program for you. Take care. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas signing off.